Welcome to False Flag Weekly News, the only weekly news show that you might have to watch off of an Icelandic server. The way things are going, it's people are being shut down all over the internet for telling truths that are unacceptable in the mainstream. So we do have this backed up at the Icelandic server that hosts my Heresy Central page, which is where I put most of my stuff. So thank you, everybody, for keeping False Flag Weekly News going. And if you want to make it even more secure, help No Lies Radio get its own server. Please do contribute what you can to our GoFundMe or fundraiser, rather, page. Well, thanks to everybody who made this week a successful one. From the fundraising standpoint, let's move on to the stories. Here we go. We have Veterans Day was observed, and so we're going to observe it from two slightly different angles from the usual ones. Jeremy, what did you think about this article about the so-called Spanish flu that killed more people than World War I did, being possibly the result of experimental vaccines given to U.S. troops? Shades of Gulf War I and the Gulf War illness. This looked plausible to me, but I don't have the specialized knowledge to know. What do you think?
Me too. I thought it was very interesting, and I can't believe that we've never heard of this to at least consider it. And it's interesting, the article describes that the actual name of this, you know, this surrounding World War One, this alleged Spanish flu that killed 50 to 100 million people worldwide, is actually is disinformation from the get-go, and says that this was actually not even a virus based on a virus, but based on bacterial pneumonic infections, really, that were likely spread, and ground zero was over here, down the road here in Kansas, at Fort Riley, and based on experimental vaccines shot up in soldiers who were about to be shipped off to war, based on an experimental vaccine brought in from the Rockefeller Medical Institute from New York City. And it describes a lot of very interesting things that really point in that direction. And even in the bigger context, I think it's very interesting in that it sort of makes a case that the amount of credit that the pharmaceutical companies and all the high-level funded scientific experimentalists around vaccine making take credit for the decrease of death rates in the modern world really should be is stolen valor from the engineers, the builders, the plumbers, the electricians who have helped us create much more sanitary conditions that are the major source of reduced sickness and death. And I would just throw in one last thing, is that we should also maybe acknowledge the potters, and that when ceramics came in and plate, my dad always points this out, that plates made of, you know, with either with a glaze or ceramics really were probably very key in terms of decreasing the amount of bacterial surface that could then be, passed to humans.
That's very interesting, Jeremy. I didn't know about the plates, but yeah, I think you're right. Obviously, sanitation has played a much bigger role in ending these diseases than the vaccines have. There's all sorts of evidence showing that. The one thing I would question about this is it blames bacterial pneumonia for these deaths, which of course occurred at the end of World War II, and then after World War One, and after World War One, and of course that the end of World War One on 11/11, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, was what's become Veterans Day here in the United States, and suddenly everybody was still dying, but from the flu, supposedly, not the war. But bacterial pneumonia, as I understand it, does kill people with flu. Like, the flu starts the process, and then bacterial pneumonia sets in. So I don't think this article has really conclusively showed that the flu didn't play any role in it. However, it certainly grounds for more investigation.
I agree. I just want to acknowledge that I would never have heard of this except for False Flag Weekly News. So I think it's a very important source to consider. And then last thing is this idea that supposedly the name Spanish on it was mainly because Spain was not involved in World War One in that case. And that so it didn't have this strong domestic silencing and propaganda laws. And so it's really where just the original sourcing of reporting came from, apparently. So I thought that was very interesting.
That's true. Yeah, very good article. We do try to consider a wide range of sources and read articles from alternative sites, from mainstream sites, try to get a good picture of what's going on. Well, here's another one from a good alternative site, Veterans Today. And I actually pasted together a couple of pieces from Laurent Guyonneau, an extract from his great book, From Yahweh to Zion, and Gideon Polya, who's over in Australia doing avoidable mortality research. And the theme of these two pieces in their own ways is that World War I set the stage for the Palestinian Holocaust.
Yes, and I think this is a very appropriate way to celebrate Veterans Day and really Armistice Day, and to point out that not only was World War I in many ways at least aggravated by the elements that sought to hand over Palestinian land to the Zionists in relationship to bringing in the United States via certain American Jewish power networks on the side of the British as a sort of a trade-off for the Balfour Declaration in many ways. But then also following that up with how that ultimately led in many ways to the context of World War II, and then Gideon Polya following it up to point out that the actual real consequences of the ongoing, we should call it, it's a world war. The World War on Terror is a world war, and Gideon Polya points out that in terms of death statistics, that 100,000 Palestinians have died due to violence since all this history, but more millions have died from forced deprivation, and the numbers are 5 million in relationship likely to violence around the larger context of the so-called war on terror, and over 30 million in terms of forced deprivation.
And that brings us to our next topic, which is the accelerating genocide in Gaza. This week, we were told by the mainstream media that a couple of Israelis got killed, and a whole bunch more Palestinians just die. This grotesquely unbalanced reporting happens even at otherwise relatively decent mainstream sites like the New York Times. if you want to find out what's really going on in this part of the world, you really do need to look at alternative sources. So what really happened over there? Well, the Israelis invaded Gaza in a nighttime raid, murdered 7 people, and it turned into a so-called botched raid. There was a firefight, and then the Israelis, the Gazans, of course, retaliated with some of their bottle rockets, which are usually pretty harmless. Israel went and slaughtered a bunch more Palestinians. Then fortunately, they've managed to get a ceasefire going. But Jeremy, the way this gets reported in the mainstream is so aggravating. The website If Americans Knew makes a lot of great points about how the big supposedly reliable media sources here in the United States are completely distorted in their coverage of these kinds of events.
Yes, and I think that's very important just to point out the linguistic context that a lot of this, the suffering is reported on by a lot of the mainstream Western media is clearly shows that they believe that Israeli concerns and lives are predominate and are more important than Palestinian lives and concerns, just in a very visceral way, let alone what that means about the problematic aspects of the actual political analysis behind the stories.
Well, the kind of emotional tone that they give you is the Palestinians are these kinds of savages who love to kill, and the Israelis are very reluctant in fighting back, when the truth is the exact opposite. For example, in this story, we learn that the Al-Qassam brigades defending Gaza intentionally targeted a bus full of Israeli soldiers, but they waited until all except one had stepped off the bus to blow up the bus. These are soldiers, so this isn't terrorism. This is legitimate warfare. The Israelis, on the other hand, are famous for doing things like that video that the guy proudly posted of offering an IDF troop offers an 80-year-old Palestinian woman a glass of water and then shoots her in the head dead. So the actual attitudes of the fighters on both sides are the exact polar opposite of what the media tries to tell us. And in the next slide, we see that one bit of fallout from all of this is Lieberman, who wants to finish the ethnic cleansing of Palestine by murdering and expelling all the rest of the Palestinians, both from Israel proper and from its occupied territories and all of Palestine, apparently, with all of greater Israel. He is resigning in protest because Netanyahu isn't murdering enough Palestinians.
This is a very interesting context of this latest Israeli hostilities against Palestine, in that it looks like that this was actually done when Netanyahu was out of town, which points to the possibility that this was actually either he was being given cover, but in this context of Avigdor Lieberman, who attacks Netanyahu from a sort of like a supremacist extreme right, and who has tie-ins to having been a KGB informant on fellow Jews and actually having been labeled by other aspects of internal Israeli intelligence as being a security risk because of his apparent close ongoing relationship as a potential mole of Russian intelligence. It makes it seem that this might be a power move by people like Lieberman and the Yisrael Beiteinu party, or the Naftali Bennett and the Home party, coming at Netanyahu from a sort of more severe supremacist right wing by trying to undermine him.
Well, this crazed extremist Lieberman, who's well known in Israel for his conviction for assaulting a young Israeli boy. You can murder as many Palestinian kids as you want, and they'll never say boo, but he actually assaulted a young Israeli boy because that boy was apparently fighting with his own son or something, and he got convicted of it.
And look
so
at
he's
this
the extremist.
Look at his eyes. Look at his face. This is,
he looks
psychotic.
Yeah, kind of like Netanyahu, only maybe even worse.
And his background is he's a Moldovan, former Moldovan, club bouncer, I guess. And so that's what it's come down to for Jewish state politics, is the failed furniture salesman of Netanyahu and the mad-eyed bouncer from Moldova, KGB agent. And both of them are psychotic, it looks like.
But the alternative doesn't look much better. I mean, these guys are supposedly extremists, with Lieberman being the ultra-extremist. But in the next slide, we see even the so-called centrist politicians are clamoring for murder and protesting because Netanyahu isn't murdering enough people in Gaza. I mean, this Yair Lapid, who's a centrist candidate who's trying to unseat the right-wing extremist Netanyahu, is saying he's going to kill a lot more people in Gaza than Netanyahu is. That's why you should vote for him. So, I mean, there's something really wrong with Israel's electorate.
Yes, there is. The so-called moderates are more and more and more extreme, and basically just attacking Netanyahu for being too much of a wimp and a peacenik. That is a very bad sign for where Israel's politics have been heading now for a long time, actually.
Well, I wonder if any of these guys are going to criticize Netanyahu for only blowing up three skyscrapers in New York on September 11, 2001 and killing 3,000 people. He should have blown up a lot more skyscrapers and killed a lot more people so the Americans would actually nuke Israel's enemies rather than just destroying them gradually.
Yeah, whereas Netanyahu said that 9/11 was very good for Israel, these people should have said that 9/11 should have been great for Israel.
That's right. We could have made Israel great again if we just nuked the heck out of the United States. Anyway, moving on to China. Seek knowledge unto China. That's a famous hadith. And the Israelis are apparently following that because they're heading over to China and selling all kinds of stuff. This article, I thought, was probably a kind of a leveraged article designed to try to convince the Americans to be nice, keep being nice to Israel, or it might run over to China and forge an alliance over there, pointing out Israel has great potential as an energy supplier and to build bridges to markets in Africa, Europe, and the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Wow, boy, China is really going to cozy up to Israel, and that's going to mess with the U.S. geostrategy. So the U.S. had better be even nicer to Israel and throw even vaster sums of money and weapons at it.
Yes, and clearly the Israeli aspects are utilizing their position here in the center of the world. And people might want to go look at Joseph Davis, former site Talpiot Talk, now known as Securing Our Interests, to get some of the background context of China and Israel and how long this relationship has been going on. And it's, some of it might even be based on this idea of the cloverleaf bunting map of the world where Jerusalem is the epicenter with Asia and Russia and China, and then Europe, and then Africa, and on the edges is the United States of America. And when you see that the vice president of China was just in Israel, the highest level officer of China in Israel in a long time, and in China taking over a major port in Israel, and this increasing cybersecurity relationship between them, and then all the reporting that we've been doing too around the taking advantage of 9/11, even like been reported by a Chinese Uyghur in the wake of 9/11 that's become concentration camps for hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Muslims in China. And you begin to see that if who could imagine it could get worse in terms of the long-term U.S. Sponsorship of this long-term occupying genocidal state Israel, but it could get worse with in relationship to having it turn towards such patrons as China and Russia and their much more problematic relationship with internal human rights.
Indeed. Well, fortunately, at this point, China and Russia are still aligned closer with Iran than they are with Israel, but these things could be gradually changing. Well, let's move on to the United States, because we all know that here in the United States, we only care about things that happen within the borders of the United States, or as Trump supporters would say, within the walls of the United States. But how about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? She can't pay rent in Washington, D.C. No wonder she's a socialist.
And it's funny how she's always attacked about her clothes, and the Fox News people basically say, "Oh, I thought she was so poor. Look at her outfit. She looks, fine." And I guess she was taken on for wearing some $3,000 jacket, but it was a photo shoot. So it was given over to her. But it really does point to the deep problems, class problems of actual representational democracy in the United States of America, where we should be able to have people who are not of great economic means who can go serve their people and not have to be dealing with not even be able to pay rent and get all set up in D.C. So it does point to a major
problem. If we had real elections, Jeremy, there might be more people like her getting elected. And one way to get real elections would be to do a series of reforms. And Robert David Steele has actually given a really good laundry list of reforms that he's been trying to push through, whatever you think about his positions on other issues. But in Maine, one of these reforms has been implemented. And for all the state offices, you can rank your choices. And the way that works is that people can actually vote for who they like rather than who they think has a chance. For instance, in 2008, when I ran for Congress here in Wisconsin, I got like 2% point something of the votes. And Cynthia McKinney was also on the ballot, only got like, 0.03% or something, because everybody was voting for Obama. In my case, a lot of people were, they just say, oh, these people like Kevin Barrett and Cynthia McKinney can't win, so why bother to even vote for them? But if there was this kind of ranked choice, somebody who thinks that Cynthia is the best choice votes for her. And then if they think Obama is second best, they're crazy enough to really think that, then they put Obama for number two. And that way, everybody is free to vote for who they think is best. So I think this is a great reform. And it's working in Maine, but this Republican, of course, Bruce Polakin, is suing to throw it off the ballot. He says it's unconstitutional because it violates the Equal Protection Clause, because those who pick only one candidate will have less say than those who rank multiple candidates. BS! That's the stupidest argument I've ever heard. Anybody has the same right to rank as many candidates as they want. What utter nonsense. This guy should have, did he graduate from law school? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. But I agree with you about Robert David Steele's suggestions, a comprehensive plan for actually creating an election system that works for everybody. And I do think these kind of, sort of tactical approaches can be really an important way to begin to open up the democratic process. And I agree with you. People should take a look at the lawsuit filed. And I'd say it's actually very interesting in terms of its political argumentation. It even appeals to saying that this this kind of voting is discourages lower income people and people of color because it's too confusing or something like that. Some interesting studies related to,
but the Republicans are so concerned about the low income people and people of color.
Yes, exactly. But I think you're right. The legal argument here, I don't think it has much standing. Apparently, it did go against the Maine Constitution. So then they passed an amendment, I believe, to the Maine Constitution because the Maine Constitution pointed out about plurality, not majority. And this is basically a process to get to a real majority and actually assess real voter intent. And but the lawsuit says that it might violate the U.S. Constitution, but nowhere does it say anything about plurality or how, whether it's a plurality versus a majority. So I think this will hold. We should probably expand this, but in a larger way, I think that all these tactical things are really a way of avoiding that we need a revolution of our political thought and process based on next generation, more synergistic political thinking that can bridge the left-right divide and more direct democracy, such as a parallel process of general assemblies. I'd ask people to go look at my proposals in the Deep Truth Conference that I did under We the People Power Politics, principles, practices, and proposals.
Okay, well, Donald Trump thinks the problem with our elections is that the poor people and the people of color sneak in and vote under multiple names because, without good ID, and so he could fix that by trying to discourage them from voting. Here he is blaming his election losses on voter fraud, which basically, if it exists at all, is in such small numbers that it has no effect on anything. Whereas election machine rigging, voting machine rigging, is a massive problem and has probably been steering the whole politics of the country now for about 15 years.
Yes, and similarly, the way that Trump sort of points in directions of real issues such as 9/11, who was actually celebrating on 9/11, then he points you to Muslims rather than Israeli intelligence, or we will find out who knocked down the towers, and then it's sort of Saudi Arabia, not some aspect of Israel and the U.S.
And then he stops talking about that once he becomes best buddies with bin Salman.
Exactly. And so even in the midst of this, he's pointed to something. I do believe this Brenda Snipes, she does seem to be some type of a deep state creature of some sort of Democrat appointed by Jeb Bush, who looks like she really did, do some very suspicious things, especially in making sure that Debbie Wasserman Schultz was elected over the more Bernie style Tim Canova in that special election. But meanwhile, you're right. So then Trump goes to things like the voter fraud canard, and people are going to their cars to switch their shirts off and wear hats and then vote again, or that people need ID to buy cereal in the supermarket. This is even worse than George H.W. Bush's out of touch comments about supermarkets.
Yeah, I've never been carded for trying to buy cereal. Like, would you have to be like under 10 years old to buy like sweet, Fruit Loops? I don't know. Anyway, moving on to more Trump madness. How about the Trump trade war? He is actually carrying on a very smart strategy. He's playing 3D chess, Jeremy, when he looks like he's doing this insane trade war that's going to ultimately destroy the U.S. dollar by forcing everybody to figure out ways to trade outside of dollars and outside of U.S. control. Here he is playing 3D chess, setting things up so that the U.S. will start mining its own rare earth metals and getting its own crucial strategic resources so it can keep supplying its own military without having to ask the Chinese. I don't know. Do you think Trump's really playing 3D chess here?
Well, at least someone, I think some faction that backs Trump, that's sort of high-level military type, strategic types, probably are doing some type of 3D chess in relationship to this. But this article really points out how are in a larger way, even beyond military readiness, which is the obvious, most blatant aspect of the looting of our industrial base. But even beyond that, our general industrial base has been looted and outsourced in large part to China. And so the military industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about about when combined with the sort of neoliberal globalization economics, as really helped out by people like Henry Kissinger, and the subversion and the shipping out of our you know, industrial base to China has really completely undermined our military readiness. And then I think that the military, of course, is one of these areas like prisons where it never made sense to outsource that kind of capacity. It's a it doesn't make sense to incentivize more production. It makes sense to incentivize exactly what we need and not be dependent on a foreign country that we're completely indebted to, that has very questionable relationship to human and civil rights. So yeah, so I think this article really needs to be considered. But even in a deeper way, we need an actual new American vision where we rebuild our industrial base in a way that is it does biomimicry in a way that is not just going to pollute the environment, and in a way that empowers our people at the same time as repairing these key nodal points of military dangers.
I like that new American vision. You know, Jeremy, maybe you should found a new think tank called Project for a New American Vision, or PNAV. Well, you know, we're going to have to pick up the pace, okay, though, here, because we're not even a third of the way through and we're halfway through our time. So let's deal briefly with this Whitaker character. His appointment is unconstitutional because the officers, principal officers of the United States, have to get approved by the Senate. He never was, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then in our next slide, we see that Whitaker's patent company was doing a lot of really interesting work for Bigfoot and for time travelers. And of course, they were then convicted of $26 million in fraud and had to settle.
Yes, and I didn't know that there was actually another Republican politician who was interested in Bigfoot porn, and so they could combine forces.
I didn't even know that existed, and yeah. I didn't want to know that existed.
Bigfoot porn in the 22nd century.
Oh my goodness. Okay, let's move on quickly from that and move on to Roger Stone ally Jerome Corsi. Says that Mueller's planning to indict him, and he says they're going to put him in prison for life for the crime of opposing the deep state. Well, it might be more complicated than that. In the next slide, we see that Jerome Corsi has indeed exposed aspects of the deep state on my radio show, where he talked about the JFK assassination, and we pretty much agreed about everything except he won't mention Israel. Jeremy, you find that to be a problem?
Yes, I think it's pretty clear that Corsi is a disinformation agent of a very specific sort. He weaponized this whole idea of conspiracy theory. He's the sort of main guy on the weaponized birther conspiracy against Obama. And of course, in the midst of this, there are real questions in all of these areas. And he somehow every time finds a way to limit the hangout or provide a red herring that almost always or always avoids the elephant in the room in a lot of these cases, which is Israel. And when you even look at the birther scenario, a lot of that tied back to Israel. One of the key people pushing that in a certain way was Orly Taitz, who was an Israeli dentist living in Orange County.
Because they hated Obama because Obama was pushing for peace with Iran.
Yes. And so this is what you see is Corsi has always been attacking Iran. He was key to attacking John Kerry to make sure that George W. Bush got back in what was really a stolen election in 2004 in order to keep up the Iraq war in a massive fashion. And so then Corsi, even in relationship to the Kennedy assassination, just like his InfoWars compatriot, Roger Stone, they finger Lyndon Johnson and never quite take the step that people like Laurent Guyonneau take, that Johnson is the key connector point to one state of Israel. So Jerome Corsi, I would just ask people to go look at an antidote that Greg McCarron and I did that was about mega Kissinger or Trump, who's really calling the shots, where it references an article by Mel Rockefeller something tax on humanity, the Poland connection, that shows that Jerome Corsi is an admitted agent of B'nai B'rith, and he's even been on InfoWars Airways talking about directly getting information from Israeli intelligence or that above it, which we surmise to be the Bronfman-centric mega group.
So he may actually just be on the wrong side of the deep state. He may not be actually opposing the deep state. Well, how about this next story of Chabad patron and Kushner partner, Putin confidant, Lev Leviev, who smuggles diamonds in condoms? Okay. That's a, I never even imagined that. I guess I never had enough diamonds to fit in a condom. Anyway, so Jeremy, tell us what this is about.
Okay. I think this is actually, you remember the book by Michael Wolff that referenced Bannon, who, by the way, is, Adelson's favorite guy, or was Adelson's favorite, most dependable guy in the White House. But Bannon said that Charles Kushner was really worried that the Kushner dirty SHIT was going to be exposed in relationship to the rabbis and the diamonds and all of that. And that's exactly what this is. That's exactly what this is. And I just want to point out one thing, that Lev Leviev is very close to Kushner, helped in the real estate deal with the former New York Times building in Manhattan, but also very close to Putin and Trump. And I just last thing, this on the left side here, you see Tamir Sapir of Bayrock. This sort of infamous Bayrock of Felix Sater, Sapir, and Arif in relationship to Trump Soho. But the background there is very interesting, that Sapir was part with Sam Kislin, I think his name was, another billionaire, Russian Jewish billionaire in Manhattan. They owned an electronics store in Manhattan that serviced all of the high-level Russian intelligence people domestically. And Trump bought a lot of his TVs that he furnished his hotels with from there. So my conspiracy theory is that this is actually that Trump's hotels have been actually surveilled by Russian at that point Soviet electronic intelligence for decades.
Very interesting stuff, Jeremy. I had no idea. Well, maybe these TVs are all set to Fox News, so that's all they can broadcast. And they have a little extra gizmo to put Trump into a trance, because he does seem to only watch Fox News, and he takes it very seriously. Well, how about this next slide? Another Trump problem, according to the New York Times, I don't see it really as a huge problem, is that Trump has made peace so far with North Korea by way of a big lie. I mean, this whole notion that North Korea is denuclearizing, come on. I mean, if you believe that, man, I'll sell you a bunch of bridges. Come on, man. They've been essentially recognized as a de facto permanent nuclear state. And the New York Times is exposing this. They're pretending to dismantle one site and they're building up all the other sites. And Trump keeps bragging that he's ended the threat. Well, yeah, he ended the threat by just shutting up about it and letting the Koreans be nuclear.
It looks like this headline too is the information that already existed about North Korea's durable programs has been weaponized by suggesting that this is some type of great deception, rather than that there's not yet a deal to denuclearize, or that nothing's really changed, and yet the New York Times is weaponizing a study by the CIIS that is very suspicious in the first place. So again, multiple deep state factions. And I'm neither nor in terms of the CIIS versus the Trump Netanyahu Putin faction. I'm for we the people globally and the U.S. Constitutional Republic here at home.
Me too. And I'm also for the truth, which is that North Korea is now a de facto permanent nuclear weapon state. Anyway, moving on to Iran, where there's a fake nuclear issue, not a real one like in Korea. This whole Trump sanctions thing was an epic fail. Oh my goodness. They were going to drive Iranian oil exports to zero after the first week in November. And guess what? Not only did it not happen, but they exempted Iran's biggest customers. The eight countries they exempted, like there's seven of them are their biggest customers. So there are no Trump sanctions on Iran. What a bunch. What craziness.
Well, one could surmise that this was actually the point of the real backers of this program, which was to actually cleave off the United States and isolate the United States from the actual global community and this actual real nuclear agreement that included Europe, and basically to further cleave off the United States from what we should have, which is a normalized economic relationship with Iran. And here, of course, is China. Pompeo admitted there was this cutout for China. I'm very suspicious of what the people backing Trump are really doing in relationship to this, and that it does not have anything to do with any patriotic or even nationalistic interests.
Well, there's oil price manipulation here too, of course, and somebody who knew this was coming could have made a ton of money by shorting this and buying that. And moving on to Khashoggi fallout. This week we learned that they x-rayed the luggage of the 15 hitmen that Saudi Arabia says just happened to get into a fist fight with Khashoggi and accidentally killed him. But the luggage that these guys brought into Turkey on the way to kill Khashoggi showed they had surgical scissors, scalpel-like cutting instruments, syringes, electroshock devices. Oh my goodness, the Saudis are the world's worst liars.
We got into a disagreement at the bar about politics, and then it ended up I had to find a vat of acid that I'd hidden in my pocket in order to dissolve his body.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what will they say next? Speaking of Khashoggi, well, we have another Khashoggi story in a bit. But yeah, here we have Snowden spilling the beans on this Israeli spyware from NSO Group Technologies that's been selling their digital burglary tools. They can break into your computer and everybody else's computer. It's called Pegasus. They sold it to Saudi Arabia. So now Saudi Arabia owns your computer, my computer, and everybody else's computer, and they can chop people up with bone saws while they're still alive. What can you say?
I appreciate that this has been highlighted. I don't know what Snowden's MO is. A lot. This is not new material, and I don't know what his appearance in Israel was all about. People should go look at a recent video that Brendan O'Connell did about this, a very interesting analysis. But this is the truth, NSO Group. Michael Flynn was on the board of a foreign intelligence-based weaponized cyber tool group. Lock them up. And now it's been spread to all of the monarchies, and it's already been used to go against the anti-corruption activists and human rights activists.
Yeah, they murdered another guy in Saudi Arabia. There was a dissident in Saudi Arabia they just killed using this software to figure out who he was and track him down. It's disgusting. Well, the next article, we have the Washington Post actually bashing Israel for helping Khashoggi. So I guess the Washington Post's loyalty to their own journalists may, in one case, have trumped, as it were, their loyalty to Israel.
Yes, and similarly to the Trump-Putin's Helsinki summit, where it was really all about Israel rather than the U.S. and Russia, and Netanyahu was the clear global victor, this is also very, very obvious and blatant and suspicious for those not already informed about this relationship of Israel and Netanyahu to MBS and Saudi Arabia, and that this is a new alignment. People should even go look at Seth Abramson on Twitter, who's just put out a very interesting book about that traces the entirety of the actual collusion story. It's very real. It's very documented. And a lot of it actually comes down to an agreement amongst Israel, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Russia, Trump, maybe Qatar in the mix. And this is really what's going on here. There has been a severe, maybe treasonous violation of the emoluments clause by the Trump crime family.
Okay. Well, I know a few of our viewers will throw rotten fruit at us for saying anything bad about Trump, but most of those people I think have left with Jim Fetzer and so on. Well, how about this great op-ed in the New York Times? When have I ever used that expression before? But yeah, I thought this was pretty good by Khaled Abu El Fadl. He's a major expert on Islamic law. I always thought of him as a real wimp, a real establishment kind of guy. Although, I mean, he criticized the Saudis in the 90s when that was a little bit dangerous. We'll grant him that. But I contacted him a year and a half ago, and sure enough, he came on my show and came out as a 9/11 truther. Well, here he's coming out as a Saudi truther. In the next slide, we see the radio show where he came on my show and for the first time and last time, I'm afraid, told us that the 9/11 official story is a fraud, and he also thinks the 1993 World Trade Center bombing is a fraud by the same people. So, tip of the hat to this major figure in the establishment who's willing to tell some hard truths.
There's almost as an Alan Hart moment in relationship to your radio show, to the Islamic world. And I almost see you in some way as it's almost like this sort of like the authentic priest role of the unburdening of one's spiritually political.
Well, that's right. He kind of confessed and apologized. He apologized to God for having been on the side of this big lie. So that was very moving to me.
You could tell he was nervous about it too. And you sort of helped him unburden himself, and it's a big deal. And so I would encourage him to continue to unpack the beautiful vision of the possibility of spiritual courage based in Islamic humility to the truth and God's creation.
Well, this op-ed the New York Times that he just did was fantastic. He pointed out that the Saudis have totally weaponized their grand mosque, and they've got their main preacher saying that bin Salman is the Mujaddid, meaning the great Islamic renewer. Give me a break. And, you know, they have Sheikh Abdulaziz al-Rais, who's like number two in the kingdom, is saying that if the Saudi ruler, bin Salman, fornicates in public on television for half an hour each day, you're all still required by Islam to bring people together around the ruler and support him. So what do you do if he chops people up with bone saws while they're still alive each day on television? I don't know. But this just shows that Sunni Islam has gone too far in the social stability thing. You know, I mean, I'm just a Muslim. I'm not a Sunni or a Shia, but I do their Sunni rituals. And from that perspective, I think the Shia have a real point, which is there's something wrong with the way leadership has become so divorced from morality in the real world of Islamic polities since the death of the Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him. But we don't have much time left, so I better stop ranting and preaching and move on to the 2 minutes of hate. That's right. We are all going to hate the hateful haters for 2 minutes. Let's hate hate. Here's a hate. This guy who shot people in Thousand Oaks, he's full of hate. Let's move on to the Washington Post talking about the hate police over at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Let's all hate those hateful people. Oh, back one slide. We have the hateful man doing Sig Heil, Heil Hitler, Heil Trump during Fiddler on the Roof. The hate, Jeremy, too much hate. And then
this guy did it because it reminded him of how much he disagreed, how it was this Trump thing. And people didn't get the joke is what happened.
Nobody understands irony anymore. Every time I write a parody or a satire, people take it seriously. And I guess this guy ran into that. Good thing he didn't get lynched for his attempt to do a little parody.
Let's move back.
Yeah. So here we have the Southern Poverty Law Center being questioned rather politely by the Washington Post once again. The next slide, we have Facebook getting in trouble for blaming Soros, right, for putting up these kind of right-wing pro-Trump ads saying that their critics are all paid for by George Soros, et cetera, et cetera. But then let's get to the real hate. Next slide, which is Alfred Schaefer is now going to be in jail or in maximum security prison for 3 years for the crime of being politically incorrect about the Holocaust. His sister, Monica, did almost a full year in maximum security lockup for doing a very sweet, kind, and utterly unhateful video. So the people who hate the Schaefers, I think, are the real haters here. What do you think, Jeremy?
Yeah, and this quotes infamous Michael Mostyn from B'nai B'rith, Canada. These people have never called out the actual hardcore mass violence anti-Semitic incitement of the 21st century. And people questioning the dynamics and the logistics and the numbers and all of this about World War II, as far as I can see, have not incited a single anti-Semitic death, as far as I can see directly. Meanwhile, the anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that the B'nai B'rith supports wholeheartedly of September 11th being driven by the hatred of young Arab Muslim men has killed millions and millions and millions, and it is very anti-Semitic, and they're nowhere to be found. And so, yes, we need to be able to protect speech. Incitement is very clear. Incitement is when you actually, it's not when you try to discuss historical events in another context or from your own research. That's not incitement. Incitement is when you directly, direct people towards a violence against a group of people, such as the 9/11 conspiracy theories supported by the totality of all of the Western institutions, government, and media. That is incitement, and it is directly created millions of destroyed lives. The Schaeffers have not destroyed anybody's lives. Debate them, disagree with them, but don't imprison people for investigation.
Well, most of what Monica says, I find fairly reasonable. Alfred, not so much. There's a lot, Alfred says excitable things that I wouldn't agree with at all, and I've argued with him on my radio show. However, I don't think not only is he not inciting violence, he's not even a bigot. That is, I have a Jewish friend who went and stayed with him, and he has no problem with Jewish people whatsoever. It's a political thing. There's certain, aspects of Jewish power that get him really excited. That's what he doesn't like. He has no problem whatsoever with people coming from a Jewish background or even of the Jewish religion. So it's not, these people are not what you're being told by the mainstream.
No, and B'nai B'rith are the anti-Semitic Holocaust deniers.
Yeah, there you go. So moving on to the neo-Nazi just arrested in Washington, D.C., Jeffrey Clark, arrested Friday last week, charged with possessing a firearm while addicted to a controlled substance, and possessing a high-capacity magazine. Okay, I don't know which magazine that would have been, Time, Newsweek, I don't even know what the magazines are these days. I read Harper's, that's about it. But, and Crescent International. Maybe he possessed a copy of Crescent International, which is by far the best magazine out there. I write for it. Anyway.
Nope. His meth addiction, like a lot of these very suspicious white supremacists and white nationalists, was his meth addiction I think would contradict any relationship with Islam.
I would kind of think so. So this guy, though, he had the nastiest online presence since Joshua Goldberg. Remember Joshua Goldberg, whose little Kill All Jews drawing got Tony Hall framed up and witch hunted out of his university? Well, Joshua Goldberg had, he actually just wrote a letter to Professor Anthony Hall. I'm breaking this news live right now at this moment. It hasn't been mentioned before. And you'll hear more about it later. But yes, there's a letter purportedly from Joshua Goldberg that we have some reason to think might be from the actual guy, if he actually exists, which we kind of think he probably does. So that's going to be interesting. But he was spreading this kill Jews, hate stuff all over the internet. And it was all a big prank and or a false flag. And so who knows about this DC neo-Nazi Jeffrey Clark? What do you think?
Yeah. Jeremy? And it's interesting. This guy supposedly, resonated with Bowers, the accused, the shooter of the shul in Pittsburgh. But people should really look at the background here. This guy and his brother, who committed suicide apparently on the same day as the Pittsburgh shooting, they were both working with one Jack Posobiec, who was working, I believe at that time, with Rebel Media, Ezra Levant, basically the Breitbart of Canada, who seems to tie together both Zionist supremacism with white supremacism in a very interesting fashion, that we're beginning to understand more and more of this relationship in the Trump Netanyahu era. It's all comes down under white Zionism.
Right. The Zio-Nazis are proving that they're not only two sides of the same coin, they're pretty much the same side of the same coin. Okay, how about War on Freedom news? We have a plan to microchip UK workers now. They've tried it out in Sweden. If you want to work at this job, you're going to have to get injected. Well, I would say take this job and shove it. I would even go so far as to say that, Ted Kaczynski, where are you when we need you?
Locked up by the people who originally put him in his position, potentially. his background as a CIA asset and study and that type of thing. And so, but what we do need is we do need to have major public reckoning with where we are headed in relationship to a potential technological tyranny and smart city gulags, all watched over by machines of loving grace. Watch Curtis's documentary. But this one's going to be ruled out of some type of antichrist supercomputer, quantum computer in Jerusalem, maybe, or the suburbs of Tel Aviv, maybe, and that's going to tie together all of the world's authoritarian governments. And but we need something different. We need to have public reasoning. And any time that we believe that governments or corporations have the right to invade our body in this way, I think is the mark. Maybe not of necessarily of the beast, but maybe, but definitely the mark of our having lost control of our own destiny.
All right. Well, they're not chipping us here at False Flag Weekly News. If they try, we're going to tell them to take that microchip and stick it where the sun don't shine. Moving on.
Shove it up Bigfoot's porn butt.
There you go. We have truth serum. That's right. The CIA was going to use this stuff called Versed, a sedative, as truth serum to try to get truth out of the people that they were trying to blame for 9/11. But then they realized what they really needed was lie serum, because they needed these people to lie and endorse their official story. So they used torture, which is lie serum, instead.
There you go. That's the perfect way of talking about it. Torture, it works to coerce false confessions.
Okay, well, maybe we're going to get some confessions to starting all these suspicious wildfires from the managers of the DEW program that has taken over from HARP. That's the suspicion, anyway, of some crazy conspiracy theorists. And you never know these days when the craziest conspiracy theory might actually turn out to be true, or at least well-founded. The campfires in California have killed, 50, 60-plus people. My own cousin lost her home in Paradise, California. Mm. This is the worst fires ever. What can we do to stop this? How did they come about? Some folks are blaming PG&E, saying a third of the fires were started by power lines that they're too cheap to insulate, falling to the forest floor. That could be one factor. Other factors, of course, are people moving into these areas with a lot of fuel load. And then there's, of course, the claim that global warming is changing the climate, making the Santana winds drier every year. And finally, we have the supposed crazy conspiracy theory that DEWs might be involved. And these pictures are very suspicious, but they're not well sourced. So some of those pictures I've seen before from previous fires. So they're reusing the same old pictures. These are not from the recent fires in some cases. I'm still on the fence on this. I don't think that there is slam dunk proof or conclusive photographic evidence that these fires were started by energy weapons. But what do you think, Jeremy?
Yeah, some of the explanations for both the Northern California and Southern California fires look like they tie into in PG&E in Northern California, and then Southern California Edison in Southern California, which points to the possibility that that's not mutually exclusive with something like directed energy weapons, because PG&E reports that they had a power outage in relationship to this time of the starting of the fire. Things like directed energy weapons could actually provoke those kinds of incidents in their usage. Of course, this kind of weaponry definitely exists. It's existed probably for decades, and there definitely is that kind of motive. But you're right, we need to be very careful in terms of the sourcing of images. We've got to get more journalistic and more analytically credible in relationship to making these cases. I do think for people who are interested in pursuing the analysis of the where these fires are breaking out and how it might relate to certain corporate interests, is there's a book called Paradise Lost. High-speed trains get waylaid, shady politicians get billions, and taxpayers get the shaft, by Richard Trainer. It points out a lot of the influence of one Dianne Feinstein and her husband Richard Bloom in this the usage of all of this sort of plans for high-speed trains to make a lot of grift a lot of public money. But I don't know. I definitely think the blockade here. People do need to look into geoengineering, and a geoengineering watch is very good. I appreciate the work that Michael Murphy really did to help launch what in the world are they spraying and why in the world are they spraying. I appreciate the efforts that he made to document this very important information. But meanwhile, people might want to go to Geoengineering Watch to see how this is actually very much a reality in terms of weather warfare.
Indeed, it's certainly plausible. As I said on the Richie Allen show a couple of days ago, Jerry Smith's book, Weather Warfare, convinced me that there's all sorts of manipulation going on that we don't hear about. And Colonel Bob Bowman, who was a friend and 9/11 Truth colleague, told me that when he was head of the SDI space weapons program under Presidents Ford and Carter, that they actually had weapons that could set entire cities on fire almost instantaneously from space. This was in the 1970s. So yeah, it's not inconceivable that something like this could be going on. People could be manipulating weather, buying futures on the various crops and so on, but then they can also be perhaps knowing what's going to burn down and what isn't, and being poised to come in and buy stuff up cheap and things like that. Short the insurance companies that are going to get blasted. There are all sorts of ways they could make money off this sort of horrible thing. I hope that's not the case, but you know, these days you just can't rule anything out. Speaking of weird, suspicious fires, how about over in Brazil, where they had a suspicious fire complete with reported explosions that supposedly caused a high-rise building to collapse, like in Tehran, where the Plasco fire a year and a half ago was pretty conclusively shown by AE911truth.org. And I've heard from my friends in Iran that this is all true. That was obviously a 9/11 style deceptive demolition. I don't know about this one. What do you think?
I guess this building has been gutted and the elevators taken out, but people were squatting there. And so, yeah, I don't know. It looks like, wow, it really looks like 9/11 in some ways. But maybe if the building were internally compromised, having been stripped down, maybe something like that would be possible. I don't know.
Well, maybe the architects and engineers can look at this one too. They did a terrific job looking at that Plasco building collapse. I made sure that some fairly high-level people in Iran have seen that. And I think they already know it to some extent. There are these same kinds of criminal organizations that operate there as here, unfortunately. Well, how about the Bank of England saying that your gold is our gold? You can't have it, to Venezuela. This is supposedly Venezuela's gold, and Venezuela wants it back, and the Bank of England won't return it. Somehow, that doesn't sound like British fair play.
No, it's almost like we're returned 500 years ago in relationship to the British Empire, in relationship to the so-called New World and the quest for gold. And the gold has now been taken in the sort of 21st century version of that through monetary warfare and the holding of banking rights and that type of thing. So, yeah, hand over Venezuela's gold, Bank of England. And Venezuela, be wary of, I heard you're incorporating a biometric identity card based on Chinese hardware.
Oh boy. Here I thought Venezuela was maybe the last great hope of our hemisphere, but it doesn't sound that way. Well, the UK's excuse for not giving Venezuela back its gold is, quote, uncertainty about Venezuela's intentions regarding that gold. Uncertainty regarding their intentions. So, okay, I hope the bank doesn't try to use that if I ever ask for, you know, if I try to withdraw money, my money from the bank. They say, oh, I'm sorry, we can't give it to you. Well, you should be uncertain about my intentions. This planet is getting just too stupid to be habitable. But fortunately, there is a super Earth, or at least a potential super Earth, nearby in space. It's called Barnard's Star. And due to the 233-day jiggles in its orbit, we now know that it has these super-Earth planets. Well, these super-Earths, unfortunately, are two giant gassy planets, three times the mass of Earth, with temperatures of -270. So I don't know if super-Earth is the sales slogan that we want to try to sell real estate on these, but frankly, these giant gassy planets could use some of our politicians, our bloated windbag politicians. So maybe we should send them over here. Then the rest of us can take good care of our planet, planet Earth, which I think is pretty valuable real estate, actually.
Yeah, and in the midst of all of the catastrophes and the danger and the disruption that we're facing here on planet Earth, while also looking out into the stars and seeing that although rare, there are other places that are inhabitable, you begin to think about the sanctity and the opportunity of life. And I just want to acknowledge the passing away of my 102-year-old grandmother, Julie, earlier this week. And I began to think about the blessings of our our ancestors and how they not only their own lives were unique and worthy and beautiful unto themselves, but they are also the thread that connected us to our moment here and to our descendants into the future. And so I just want to give thanks to our ancestors and also offer a gratitude for them having loved us and shown us love over the course of their life, and that we may pick up even greater responsibility here in this present to make this place that we inhabit a beautiful place for all of our future descendants.
Amen, Jeremy. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. That's we're from God and to God we return. May your Grandma Julie's return to God be a blessed one. And I had a grandmother who died at almost 100, who was a huge influence on me. She was an ecologist before her time. So yeah, these wisdom of the ancestors is something we should definitely keep alive. Well, all right. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you, producer Alan Reese, and our whole team here at False Flag Weekly News. We'll be back next week, God willing. Till then, have a great week.